is a graduate of the University of Dayton as well. He did his medical training at the UCLA School of Medicine and his residency training at in family medicine at the University of Washington. He also at Washington received a master's degree in public health. This recognition of Family Doctor of the Year represents a very interesting shift which has taken place, I think, in the medical profession. The recognition in past years, as I understand it, has been particularly of quite senior doctors, but as in other areas of science, there's been a conscious change in trying to recognize the pioneering work that younger physicians were doing in opening up the area. As all of you know who have been present at previous discussions on science advising, we have put the emphasis, or others have placed the emphasis, on fields such as physics, the whole area of economic competitiveness, the weaponry area, defense and security, but we've, in a sense, neglected the biomedical field. And I thought it was especially important, therefore, that we have an opportunity to discuss this, and I think we will try to seize several other opportunities to do so if the chance should present itself. But I can't think of a better way to open the topic in our, as part of our emphasis on science advising, than to do so with Dr. Sugar, about whom we've already heard a lot, but about whom we'll be hearing more and more in years to come, given the significant work that he's doing at the University of California, Davis, where he is a faculty member, as all of you know. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Kenneth, thank you very much. I'm honored to be here. I would like to get to know all of you better. I know our time is short and won't do that now in the formal presentation, but I hope that for some of you might stick around afterwards and find out this group I'm speaking with. It's a real honor to be here at the Miller Center. As a Kellogg Fellow, I've been challenged to spend 3 years, part of my time, I'm still an active practicing physician and teacher, but 25% of my time is to be spent in learning outside of my field, and my being here is an exercise in that learning. I do not come to you claiming to be an expert in biomedical research funding. In some ways, I'm more of an outsider than an insider, but I enjoy the opportunity to raise some questions and express some concerns. I think some of what I'm going to say might be considered controversial, maybe even heretical, and when you talk about the negative more than the positive, you're doing a lot of risk-taking. Again, I accept that sort of challenge and hope that I can raise some germane questions. I think you could subtitle my presentation, Research Funding and the Quality of the University Environment, which again is very broad. What do I mean by quality? I would define a quality university environment as an environment in which there is an appropriate balance between the missions of the university. And as I would see it, the university environment has three major missions, education, research, and service. And a quality university environment is one that maintains that balance. My focus and my experience has almost exclusively been in the medical school environment, which is in many ways a peculiar and unique environment. Although I'm going to be talking about the big picture, the forest, as opposed to the trees, and I believe that much of the general statements that I'm going to make have applicability across into the other sciences in the university. What I'm going to say is based on personal observation. I've not done research in this. I'm not ready to give you all of the facts and figures of number of grants and dollars. I am familiar with much of that information, but much of what I'm going to express has been based on observation. My background was mentioned. I'd like to just add a little bit to that. At the UCLA School of Medicine, prestigious institution, was very honored to go there, enjoyed my medical education a great deal, was successful there, elected into the Alpha Omega Alpha Honor Medical Society, but made an observation at UCLA, which I think is a prototype of a academic health center, is one, all of the academic faculty were compelled to have an active research career. Some were highly accomplished in this, were doing cutting-edge work, clearly very important, and I have the utmost respect for biomedical research that is advancing our knowledge, advancing the many things. Really, medical research has changed the course of history. Many examples of that. But also, and probably in greater numbers, seem to be conscious of faculty who were doing research because they had to survive. Their skills in the research were not there, and actually had some encounter with faculty members who quite honestly were probably not doing legitimate research, and had at least one experience of being aware of data fabrication in order to achieve publication. I then went to another excellent medical school, University of Washington in Seattle, one that is always been in the top five in NIH funding, where I was a resident in family medicine. Family medicine, by the way, is a fairly new field, one that is trying to achieve its academic respectability. And maybe some of my comments and observation is as a leader in this new field, we're under a great deal of pressure to conform to the tradition of departments in an academic institution, of course, which is a mandate toward research publication to survive, an activity which has tremendous value if put in its proper perspective and balance. But had the same observation. I enjoyed being with some of the most talented and effective researchers in biomedicine there, but also at the same time was observing, again, the mandate on other faculty who my exposure to them and conversations with them revealed that that research was not a high priority for them. It's not why they were in medicine. They loved to teach. They loved patient care. They loved being around the university. And somehow to survive, they would participate in quote, scholarly research. As I did my master's in public health, for the reason that I wanted to be more than just a clinician, I wanted to understand the healthcare system as well as I could, I got training in the broad area of health services, with some of my training was in health services research, courses in statistics, quality research, how to read the literature critically, and spent some time looking at the medical literature, quality journals and journals of lesser quality, seeing how in general some departments in academic medicine more than others do quality research. I left, it's been 12 years since I finished that training. I've been a practicing family physician in Northern California for the past 12 years. I have an active practice. I'm the managing partner of a family practice group. I have approximately 2,000 active patients that I care for with a group of five family physicians, and we take care of a town of about 7,000 people, 8 miles from the university town of Davis. So you can imagine me as a practicing family doctor in a community 8 miles from Charlottesville. For the past 10 years, I've been also a part-time faculty member at the University of California, Davis. I was really hired to be a clinician teacher. I hold a faculty rank in the clinical series. Been very active in medical education. I have a large number of courses that I'm responsible for. Many of them are the off-campus courses. I have more advisees than any other faculty member in a medical school. So I'm a very popular faculty advisor to students. I chaired the curriculum committee of our medical school for a year and a half. I've also maintained my academic career, been very active in the Society of Teachers of Family Medicine, which is the academic organization of our field, was president of that organization in 1986. We were dealing in family medicine with trying to define our research focus. And so that's a little bit of more handle on my background. A reflection, kind of a conclusion that I've made in terms of the problem of imbalance. First of all, I feel that there is too often an imbalance in the research, education, and service. That the mandate of research on faculty is such that teaching and service in medicine, that's patient care, that actually teaching and patient care may well get in the way of the person's survival. And we see so often teachers refusing or not being unwilling to take responsibility to teach courses, unwilling to take responsibility for patient services because they are required, and often there's actually a written and unwritten rule that unless you spend about 80% of your time in research activities, you're not going to be able to do the quality work that's required to make it by current standards. That the research funding, the extent of research funding post-World War II, which has caused our acceleration of medical knowledge, science knowledge, faster than any time in history, which has had a tremendous positive effect, is also largely responsible for the current imbalance, where virtually all academic faculty must be accomplished researchers in order to survive. My own chairman in family medicine has been told by the dean of the medical school that we expect that 80% of your faculty will be researchers of record nationally, and that you might have room for 1 in 5 of your faculty to have medical education and patient care as a higher responsibility than their research activities. In a sense, an 80-20 rule that the other departments in the school are expected to follow. Clearly, success in the university is often defined by the size and number of research grants that are there in the school. So what is the fallout? I'd like to list what I think are 5 problems that are a result of this imperative and the current situation. One is a lack of teachers. One of the clearly visible things that occurs in most of our medical schools, despite a very large faculty, is that there's a lack of time and interest in teaching. And students often complain about this, and it's been articulated in a number of writings. One of my medical students that I work with, one of the top students at the University of California, Davis, was reflected on it in his own undergraduate career, and I think that's why it translates beyond medicine. This particular student transferred his own college. This is prior to medical school. He was a college student at the University of California campus in San Diego and found that he did not feel that teaching was a priority of most of the faculty he was interacting with, and actually transferred to a state university in order to have a more stimulating dialogue between teachers and students. But then in terms of the medical school, finding faculty who would commit the time to teaching is very difficult. Another fallout is poor quality research. And I'd like to quote Kenneth Thompson here in some of his books, because I think there's a part of the introduction that you've put in this series on science advising that is apropos. There's a quote that too often individual research proceeds on issues bearing no relationship to each other, especially with social problems, and I think medicine is a social science to a great extent. Such dispersion of effort tends to be the norm unless students and researchers can focus their energies on a common problem or an informing theory. Another fallout is in a sense, less service. I think it's ironic that many of our academic health centers are in urban environments where you have an academic health center with a large number of faculty, very busy. The research mandate and literally a block away are people that are receiving compromised or limited health care in terms of the service area. There's an excessive literature. The growth of our scientific literature has reached a point where it has now become impossible for anyone, even in a focus field, to stay abreast. We're into abstract reading. We're into a situation where we've got a mega information. Take one field, for example, in medicine, such as neurology, actually has 9 academic journals that are published in the U.S. alone in the National Library. We have a situation where the size of the literature is gotten what I think is out of control. And there's a loss of intellectual purity. And I'm not sure what the history is here. Maybe there was never intellectual purity among research and science. But we have a situation now where I was just reading a recent article where research fraud has become an increasingly recognized issue. There have been several very prominent cases of research fraud. There's now an agency in Washington that's looking at that, that is estimated actually that as much as 25% of the published literature in medical science is to some extent fraudulent or may involve studies in which data has been fabricated in order to achieve publication. Short-term goals, numbers of publications per year are pressures that are put on a lot of faculty. There's an enormous pressure to get studies out as quickly as possible. So what can be done? I'd like to more raise questions. I don't claim to have the answers by any means, but I feel that that some change needs to happen in order to shift the balance in our universities back to an appropriate balance of research, education, and service. Not to slow down true advancements. I in no way am anti-science, anti-research in terms of quality. But could a change in policy and research funding correct the imbalance? Should there be better organization of where funds go? Should there be more focus to our funding? Maybe more dollars to some, focusing more on quality instead of quantity of research? Can we support a nation in which 125 medical schools are all filled with faculty who can live by an 80-20 rule in which 80% of all their academic faculty must be accomplished researchers? If the research dollars weren't there for everyone, what would happen? Have the dollars actually few, you know, it's a kind of a chicken or egg question. Have the availability of having so many people focusing on research created the monster? Or, did the monster go after and find the funding? If the dollars weren't there in terms of the volume and numbers, if we did focus ourselves into true centers of excellence with enough variety and enough of them such that there would be some competition and growth, could we survive and have a shifting and balance more toward the education and service? I'd like to close there and leave those questions out. I'd be most interested to learn from you what your thoughts on what I've said.
Well, we've got some doctors, we've got some lawyers, we've got the medical people, and other than that kind of back, other than the doctor's experience, we've got some international foreign service agricultural officers, so we can get questions from many different vantage points, even political science.
Well, let me ask the question. What's the difference between general practitioner of the old days and family practice today? I don't know.
The family practice was created to preserve the general practitioner. So that's the short answer. The little more, the next layer answer is that to practice competent modern medicine, it was felt that training designed to produce a good family physician was needed, that medical school and 1 year of internship were not enough. And so to make general practice a specialty, it was very controversial whether or not to change the name from GP to FP, and it was felt that in order to legitimize the specialty, we needed a new name. So they gave it a new name. But we are really the heirs to general practice.
I can see what would be gained in terms of your concerns by cutting back the 20-80 ratio to 50-50 or maybe even 40-60 kind of ratio, or confining the 20-80 ratio to some selected institutions, maybe a third of them or something of that sort. What would be lost? In other words, would you get less research that is significant accomplished, first of all? Secondly, would you have a kind of medical school situation which some medical schools would now consider first rate and others were second or third rate, the latter being primarily teaching and service? And would that in turn make it difficult to recruit deans and faculties?
Those are very good questions. To some extent, the first rate, second rate already exists. U.S. News and World Report, as you probably know, ranked their top 10 institutions by surveying deans. And the top 10 medical schools were almost synonymous with the top 10 research fundings. My impression is, as I've watched many of my fellow students and residents pursue full-time academic careers, that there's a fair number that really go into academic careers because of the stimulation of education and teaching, that they want to be clinician teachers. Yet the prestige is in an academic tract that really compels them to pursue, and they will take certain time out and others to try to develop some legitimate research skills, some of often which I think is really not that good of training. And also, only 5% of medical students ever do any academic work. 95% of the people that go to medical school are there to learn how to practice medicine well. And I think that as long as there is at least recognition for quality education and service if we could change our reward system to some to recognize centers of clinical excellence. The Mayo Clinic has always been in that model, for example, for clinical excellence with a modest amount of research, you know, some would argue it's greater, and it probably is greater now than it's been before. They now have a medical school there. But you can have centers of clinical excellence and teaching excellence recognized as such. But I think what you're suggesting would be real appropriate.
Dr. Aldridge.
Well, the problem there is that as long as the federal government finances as much research as it finances, it's very difficult to concentrate on centers of excellence. Some of you, I'm sure, have sat in on federal study sessions where research grants are awarded. And you certainly do get the implication that if Harvard gets much more of what they already get, much more than what they already get, there's going to be a rebellion in those who determine where the money goes. And those who determine where the money goes are the representatives from states which I won't name, but which don't have Harvards, and don't have UCLAs, and don't have University of Washington's. And that there's a great deal of pressure to spread it around. And I think you'll find that even in a state, if you have a state with one distinguished academic medical school and a couple of others that have less claim to that, there's a good deal of pressure to make sure that the ones that don't are going to get some of the so-called goodies. So I'm not sure that it is it's practical to establish research centers of excellence as long as funding is primarily federal government. I don't know whether the political scientists around this table would agree with that.
Well, you make the comment, and I have wondered, maybe naively, that actually reduction in federal funding for biomedical research would be a good thing for the future of biomedical research and medical education. That just the ability of having enough money to spread it around so much. And give an example of my own school that I've been involved with now for a decade. The University of California at Davis was really established in California to be a medical school for Northern California, the huge numbers of rural counties. It was established to be different than UC San Francisco and UCLA, which are the prestigious research institutions of the state. But our dean and there have been a number of these medical schools which were established in 1970 really to provide the service that the studies of the 60s say we have a doctor shortage in rural America. We don't have enough doctors out there to take, and these new schools were established really to provide more doctors for people. Yet the institution clearly wants to become another UCLA or another UC San Francisco and strives to do that, you know, in a sense because of the availability and of the funds enough to, in a sense, be spread around. And, you know, how many should there be? And I think when the carrot is there, in such large numbers, the drive to go after the carrot is becomes the all-encompassing mission of the institution.
Is that true of the doctors who want to go into have something to do with teaching? As you said, you like to teach, you like to treat patients, you like to be around the university, and that's exactly where you are. And you are teaching and treating patients and being around the university. And that, it seems to me, the clinical ladder, as contrasted with the academic ladder, is perhaps where you can do something to redress this balance. Because if you made the clinical ladder, if you strengthened it, including provided more funding for it, then you would get back to the era where clinicians would be doing the clinical teaching and researchers could spend their time in the laboratories and not be the primary teachers, be the secondary teachers or the specialized teachers. If it works for you, why didn't it work for the rest of the medical schools? I mean, in your particular area.
Well, I think a healthy clinical ladder is clearly a positive direction. We don't have that. I mean, we have an 80-20 rule even in our own institution, and I would argue in a field, first of all, I don't think all fields should have the same intensity of research. Family medicine needs to have a healthy research base because primary care research is quite important. But I would argue that the ratio ought to be reversed, and we have maybe 20% of our faculty who are devoted to research and 80% of the faculty in a clinical teaching mode. But we don't have a healthy clinical ladder, one that is considered comparable. If you're on the clinical ladder in many institutions, you don't have any vote in the faculty senate. You do not, you know, there are a number of things that you don't have in the university that would put you comparable to, you know, there's often not a tenure system, for example, in the clinical series. You're second class and low in number. And when funding gets tight, the state funding, the institutional funding gets tight, you're often the first to go unless you can maintain yourself strictly on patient care dollars only. That's happening to some extent. We're also having a lack of teachers because those who are surviving on patient care dollars more and more all of a sudden have to spend so much of their time in patient care they don't have time to teach either.
I think much of what, we agree with much of what you said. Now, there's one thing I don't, in my experience, the 80-20 is not ubiquitous. There are plenty of schools where 80-20 is not enforced. Now, those may be the schools that don't have the high prestige, but there's schools that are not, by your definition, centers of excellence then, and there only should be a few centers of excellence, and perhaps there only should be a few schools with 80-20s. The real problem is how to get whoever determines the funding, and that's very often the legislators, to recognize that clinical teachers, that is people in practice as you are, who go in and teach for their stint and are not expected to do research, clinical teachers should get much more support than they're getting in this or any other state.
Mrs. Fernbach.
I'm a doctor too, even though you always call me Mrs.
I'm sure you understand that you
can never make that mistake again.
I used to be a general practitioner in the country over in Fishersville, Virginia, but now I'm a psychiatrist. I was wondering if you had any ideas as to what could be done to enable the people who are really having terrible medical problems in our country to benefit more from this research, and how it could be applied to reducing our infant mortality rate, or how it could benefit our terrible problem.
Well, excellent questions. Much of our poor health statistics in our country are due to social problems more than medical problems.
Pretty hard to separate them, isn't it?
Very hard to separate them. But for example, you know, our poor infant mortality rate is almost entirely due to the terrible infant mortality rate of black women in America, most of which are concentrated in urban centers. And if you look at why their infant mortality rate is high, they don't receive prenatal care. Why don't they receive prenatal care? And there are a number of, be it from drug use, single, having no support system, teenage pregnancies, et cetera, et cetera.
Is it that the doctors are too busy doing research instead of treating somebody?
No. Well, ironies, for example, in funding is a large hospital in downtown Oakland, give an example, closed its clinic, is not able to take these women who will show up for prenatal care because the funding for the clinic in that county hospital was lost, could no longer afford to take care of the poor women, while at the same time is expanding its neonatal intensive care unit, is resolving the funding that's available for the intensive care of the sick newborn. We now have data that shows very clearly that for every dollar that's spent in prenatal care, you save $3 of neonatal intensive care. Yet that's, in a sense, where the money is. That's where the biomedicine, if you will, is.
Why?
The whole academic reinforcement system is going to reward a person who's at the cutting edge of survival of a low birth weight baby on a neonatal intensive care unit with an enormous amount of literature and research, etc., than it would be to support how to get a cocaine dependent woman to get better medical care. In a sense, one is soft, sociologic, applied, and the other is technical, academic, and of much higher. And I'm not sure it's completely fair to say these are either or. We're really talking about apples and oranges. But we have a situation in America. Well, first of all, if you look at where our biomedical research funding goes, almost none of it goes to what I would call community medicine. That is applied research to help the problems of people in a community on a frontline level. You know, there's no institute of primary care or community care. And our schools of public health, even the ones that try to address this, are barely surviving financially. We put our money into really biotechnical things, and our problems are really not lack of technology, it's lack of basic primary care to a great extent. So you've got this big imbalance, and clearly there could be some shifts. The big problem is that there's no new money. You know, with our federal deficit, with our problems, everyone agrees that the problems are there. Where do you grab the money to do it? And it's hard. There's no new money on the either the state or the national level. And because of no new money, I think the difficult shifts are gonna have to take place in order to put the money in these areas where they need to be.
How are the criteria determined for the areas or subjects for all this research? Or is it just a completely limitless universe with little or no comparative valuation of which area is more worth going into than which other? I mean, if you change the 80-20, you'd have to do less of something in research.
Well, I'm not an expert on how decisions are made at NIH, and I think some people around this table are much more familiar than I. But it's a very complex mechanism. There is a lot of controls put on it. I mean, it's not just sort of willy-nilly spread the money, or it's not really a club that's totally self-serving either. I mean, there are mandates that come down, but there are great imbalances in the amount of money that is put in different areas. If you look at the amount of money that's put into alcoholism, for example, and compare and smoking-related deaths, talk about public health. I mean, those two things, shorten life far more than cancer does. I mean, cancer is an important problem, but it's pale compared to smoking and alcohol-related deaths. Yet the amount of money that NIH gives out in smoking cessation programs, people doing research in smoking cessation and alcoholism is very, very small compared to, you know, heart. You know, you have the topics that capture, you know, right now we have, you know, a few senators and a whole select committee on aging that wants NIH to give Alzheimer's disease, you know, all of the funding it deserves in comparison to this, that, or the other thing. But again, the real dilemma is there's no new money. So you've got to start taking away. I can't help but believe in America that right now, that with where we've gone from 1950 or 60, wherever you want to start it, to now in terms of all growth, it's really all growth. And the only reductions that have occurred have been very modest. They tend to be across the board 10% reductions. And those, but we've really not made some fundamental shifts, decisions, and changes. And they're going to be very hard. The New England Journal of Medicine just published an article that said they surveyed all of the prestigious medical journals in the world, the top three or four, and they commented that the number of articles written by American authors has declined in these journals in the last 5 or 10 years. And that's a symbol that we're sliding and we're no longer the world leader. Maybe we're going to lose ground. My comment to that is good research is being done all over the world. Why do we have to dominate the world's biomedical literature, number one? I mean, it's this whole attitude that America has to be the supreme and overpowering force in everything. And then, but then also, you know, and then they directly correlated this shift of our own percent of the world literature to the decline in research funding that's occurred, and blaming that. So, I mean, you have these forces to maintain the status quo, which are quite strong.
Can I connect this to a different vantage point? Research is the driving force, the driving engine for the medical school. And if we don't move forward, we automatically fall back. Secondly, it's a global situation where we can't address secondary issues if, as you say, and I'm convinced that you're true, it's true that beginning with World War II, we were preeminent in the field of biomedical research. We spend something like $7 billion out of the budget of Trillium, which is less than 1%. But from this, we are perceived in every country in the world as the leader. We are the preeminent country that all physicians all over the world try to come to so that they can learn what is new. So, and secondly, having sat on a study session for 4 years, in answer to your question, the decision and the priority scores are purely on scientific merit, nothing else. So that, yes, you have problems in delivery, but I don't think that you want to jeopardize or minimize this driving force. Right now, because of funding, last year only 29% of the grants, which were approved by study sections, were funded. This year, this will go down to 20, which is the lowest rate that we have ever had. So we get all of this money for AIDS, for the Genome Project, but in the process, we are eroding our research base, and we're eroding it at a very rapid rate. I have a 5-year grant. I get this grant every year. We automatically are reduced so they can spread this very thin amount to the main body of research in this country.
And then I have the state of Virginia mandating that the people I have on this go, they have to be increased. So to me, the whole situation has become a nightmare in terms of research. Now, as you say, in healthcare delivery, yes, they are gaps, but we have to address those, I think, independent of preserving what we have done better than any country in the world. But if you look at the Japanese and the Germans, obviously, in the years ahead, if we don't maintain our position, we will certainly fall to the second or third great power now in this field. Now, you can say, well, we don't have to be that, but if you look at biotechnology, all of the money's coming in from this, we look at it from our business standpoint, we can't jeopardize it.
I agree with much of what you say. If you cut the wastage and kept the quality, you don't compromise excellence. And there's just an enormous amount of wastage, garbage, in university research. And the fact that it, and a lot of that garbage continues because the funding is there to maintain it. And when scholars and leaders such as yourself cry erosion, when the fat is cut off, is part of the problem, and maybe it's a necessary political response. I would not suggest that we should compromise our excellence and our leadership. I think that there's a lot of us in my generation who consider the tone of what you say, though, almost imperialistic, that somehow the U.S. has to be ahead of everybody else. Why can't in our modern world, the world we're coming toward, accept the fact that there's going to be at least one center in France and in Germany and Japan that's as good as NIH or wherever, that other, just because other countries are up to speed with us, we haven't fallen back. That doesn't imply that we've fallen back. You know, this whole notion of global sharing. You know, I enjoyed reading in here about the politics of the superconductor collider, and whether or not the superconductor collider ought to be a worldwide effort, or whether we ought to do it ourselves, which would keep us as the preeminent a power in the physics. And the decision really was to keep it in our own borders rather than have it be a multinational effort. It was interesting, the NASA issue of how much should that be just U.S. versus multinational. And our politics have made everything a mess. Part of the reason it's a huge mess is because of the federal deficit. I think that all of us need to be responsible citizens with respect to the federal deficit and trim our fat and become efficient without losing the real force. A lot of our own inflation here in America has, and labor, the whole labor situation, et cetera, is probably as guilty as anything to have us fall behind. Healthcare is a lot to blame for why we fall behind technical, because the cost of healthcare in America is as big a cause as anything of why our automobiles aren't competitive with Japan and a lot of other things. But that's a whole separate issue. But I think that we can maintain, what we've got to somehow do, no one in our self-interest lobbying, you know, we are filled with people who are lobbying to maintain their own status quo in a time when maintaining the status quo is becoming increasingly untenable. And what I observe is the sort of absolutely adamant don't erode biomedical research. If you accept the fact that not everybody on every medical school faculty in an academic position needs to be an active researcher, that you find the balance try to strike the balance that there can't be some greater efficiency, some trimming of the fat without actually jeopardizing the product.
Yeah, well, I would like to reply to your question. Scientific imperialism, we've been working with the French for 10 years. Now, the French have been doing the experimental work, the French have been doing the clinical work. We've been working with a group in China, and I can't cooperate effectively as I should with the Chinese, which I'd love to do, and the French, and the Italians, and the Canadians. So, but I'm just saying that this is not a question of the imperialism, but when you look at our defense budget of $300 billion, our biomedical research budget of $7 billion, what do we want to be perceived as?
I couldn't agree with you.
The thing is that this is pittance, peanuts, compared to all of the other efforts we put into our activities in terms of research. And so I think it's important to keep, since we are moving more toward a global interaction with all spectra of science, industry, you name it, that it is to me unwise to erode our position in the field that we have had the greatest strength.
I don't think the $7 billion probably ought to be cut relative to everything else. Maybe it needs to be consolidated somewhat. I'm calling for, I'm a person who's kind of out there in the hallways and not caught. I'm an observer of the academic milieu and watching people's careers move through it and see the rules of the game and the impact, kind of out there in the grass, in the field. And see that the research mandate that so permeates academic medicine to virtually everywhere is actually almost career destructive and destructive to the balance of forces at the medical school. That by don't cut the research funding on the big level, but consolidate it into clear centers and not, Virginia as an example. University of Virginia may have several of the recognized centers of excellence. It may have other departments that are purely clinical and teaching. Give an example in California. California doesn't need another neurosurgeon. It has enough neurosurgeons to take care of everybody in California and then some. We have 9 places training neurosurgeons. Well, why do they train neurosurgeons? The neurosurgical faculty can't do the neurosurgery because they're doing academic work, so they need neurosurgery residents to do the neurosurgery. Nephrology, right at our own institution, we can't give up our nephrology fellowship because all of a sudden the nephrologists, who are all maintaining themselves academically would be doing the nephrology. That we need to shift. We need to do some shifts away from overtraining and to in some areas in some institutions shift probably into a clinician teacher mode almost entirely. There needs to be some consolidation there. I think in the big picture we completely agree.
Sure. Well, now having said that side, I'll come over to your side and say that I think one of the big problems facing American medicine is this increase in high technology. And this is a competitive thing. Everybody's got to have, everybody's got an MMR, everybody else has got to have. And you see, this, to me, drives up the cost of medicine.
Absolutely.
Out of proportion to what this really contributes. Now, I was trained in internal medicine, I hate to tell you when, but I still think that a good clinician with excellently trained is the most superior technical instrument we have.
Absolutely.
And what we're having, if you look at the cost of care in this country compared with it, it's the most costly care per patient of any country in the world, yet we're not competitive with other countries in delivery. So we've got to find some way to say that cut back on technology and reintroduce good sound medicine. This would be my retort.
Hear, hear. I agree completely.
Knight, you were on this specific point, or?
Well, yeah, when I was with the medical school, we had no paid clinicians teaching. They were all in practice when they came in and taught. And the most prestigious hospital in my community was the county hospital. That's where everybody wanted to be trained because that's where the best teaching was. Now, both those have changed enormously, 100%, 180 degrees have changed since I went to medical school. And I don't think that it, I think it is a change in attitude and a change in general public feeling, of the kind of feeling that says we'd rather deal with a helicopter to bring one baby from another county than to run a clinic. We've seen in the development of all kinds of helicopter medicine and all that that implies, you've seen the dissolution of Philadelphia General Hospital and a lot of the hospitals that were set up to treat the people who don't get, who are on the low, who bring the infant mortality rate up. And at least for the last 10 years, what we've seen is a steady erosion of funding for the kind of thing that Philadelphia General Hospital represented, and a steady increase up until very recently in funding for very high technology, which means it seems that that's what the people want. That your representative from Minnesota is more proud of the Mayo Clinic than he is of Hennepin General Hospital.
Right.
He's more, and if you don't, I mean, that's where the action is. It is in a way somewhat like cutting the military bases. No legislation will permit that military base to be cut. No legislation wants to cut the grants that go to make the Mayo Clinic what it is. And I think you really have to deal with this on the basis of the people's priorities. And our priorities, this country's priorities, have been in the interest of high-powered scientists, more in the interest of delivery of care to the underprivileged.
Where do you fit the high tech that every intensive care unit has now, which I, in theory, used to think was something that good, strong people didn't need when they had surgery, but then I saw how vital it was with my wife. I think high tech becomes a popular cause when somebody in your family has gone through repeated surgery, and then you say, oh, you suddenly have a conversion.
Well, there's a big ethical question, because are we going to give high tech to everybody? Are we going to give high tech to the Alzheimer's disease patient in the last few months of his life? And a lot of the problems you're talking about have come through the success, at least to some extent, medicine's success in extending the lifespan, but not extending the quality of life at the end of it. So we're able, I mean, look at the problem of you wear helmets on motorcycles. Well, if you don't, you get, it isn't just the fellow that gets killed or injured, you get spinal cord injuries, which the taxpayer then has to
take care for the rest of that individual's life. Whereas a few years ago, when I went to medical school, they all died, so there was no problem. So you have more and more of the of the concern about where you leave off in high tech. And since the infant mortality, since the clinic for the prenatal clinic is not nearly as dramatic or as sexy for getting funds, that gets lost. This is a much broader problem than the academic centers. It's a problem of society generally in this country.
Mr. Fernbach.
Sir Fernbach. It seems to me that if you want to, as a political scientist, if you want to get more money diverted from the military to, let's say, new grants for new areas of medical research, then you need to have a biomedical set up in the important constituencies of Congress members in order to generate your support, following the example of the military. Not being facetious, though, I wonder whether, in fact, you don't have to look at your lobbying power and whether your county medical societies, where you have primarily practicing physicians and people who are concerned with the service end, and therefore also, I would assume, the teaching end, probably, is a good place to generate some of the support you need to make the shifts away from the attractiveness of glamour, which is often there. Let's assume simply that we have a certain percentage of people engaged in research who ought definitely to be in research and are doing a bang-up job there and making a tremendous contribution. The real problem is that glamour edge and the general vested interest in the view that you don't have a good medical school unless you have a 2080 division. And to turn that around, you can't expect the medical schools to say, gee, we were wrong, very soon at least. It seems to me you have to create a pressure, counter pressure to that, mm-hmm. and it might well come through your AMA people, your county medical society. Is that possible?
I think it is. I think you make some excellent points. I was at the National Health Forum last month in Washington, which brought in 30 or 35 of the eminent scholars in our healthcare dilemma and problems. And there was a consensus that until society experiences enough pain by the lack of resources and healthcare being focused properly, will there be change? And maybe that'll occur in this decade. They were all predicting a national health insurance by 1995 that way. You're exactly right. The AMA is one of the largest lobbies in Washington, and my own state medical association, which the counties feed to, the California Medical Association, one of the most powerful lobbies in the state. The problem in organized medicine is getting consensus around issues that we're talking about. It's easy to get consensus to not cut doctors' incomes and not regulate doctors more. Those are easy issues. But issues of shifting research priorities, shifting social priorities, is impossible. If you look in my own state medical association in California, the deans of the medical schools sit on the scientific board. And so I'm on the committee for medical schools up there. But these committees are very oriented to maintain the status quo. I mean, it's very hard to get people in organized medicine to admit there really are real problems. I mean, that we have anything to do with the problems. They're all social problems. They're all political problems. The status, maintaining the status quo is an overriding force.
My experience is that you do, in fact, in a democracy, make the shifts, but it takes 10 or 15 years or 20 years sure. to get it.
And they're going to come from public pressure. I think you expressed that so well. As what do we really want? And it's not going to be probably until the voting middle class start suffering from the lack of their insurance is too expensive, their employer is cutting it, and things that say, wait a second, we've created a monster that's too expensive here. We're spending per capita this year, we'll spend about $2,400 per person in healthcare, which for a family of four is getting close to $10,000 a year. Well, how do you buy insurance for something that's going to cost a family for $10,000 a year? Well, that's an $800 a month insurance premium. And who's willing to pay $800 a month for their health insurance? I don't know many people that are willing to put that into their budget. And the employers are saying no, too. So all they're doing now is skimming the population, trying to find clusters of healthy people to insure, and so they can avoid the unhealthy people. And, you know, now if you want to get insurance when you change jobs, all of a sudden pre-existing conditions won't be covered. So if you've got a wife with rheumatoid arthritis and you get shifted from one company to the other, they used to just put you in the company's plan and your wife in too. Well, now all of a sudden you can't change jobs because you can't change your health insurance anymore. It's a terrible situation.
Bill Harberly.
With all the research, is there any system of monitoring the quality of family practice? I have specifically in mind, our son wanted to be a dentist all his life, and he went to dental school, and in his third year he got a commission in the Navy, went into the Navy, very enthusiastically, did his internship at Oakland Naval Medical Center. Thought it was excellent. He really was, and they had professors coming in from the university there, of course. Subsequently, he was assigned to a field unit, a Marine battalion. And of course, there you have a captive clientele. He was doing all his work properly as he had been taught to do. Subsequently, in come officers that have gone into private practice, didn't make it there. They come in, they are not up to date on what the most modern things are. Their interest is in their grade promotion, which runs not necessarily in tandem, but separately, so that they're even willing to falsify records. They will do all sorts of things. I mean, his enthusiasm has just gone out, and he plans to leave. Now, you would think that with the military being a government institution, there would be some medium to monitor this so that you would get the latest into the field practice. I mean, ordering medications of various kinds, he finds that superior officers are not even acquainted with them. And the only breath of fresh air is when a professor comes down from one of the universities who is a reserve officer who is on the cutting edge of modern developments in dentistry.
You're touching on the whole issue of quality of care as it exists out there. And the new field of family medicine has really led the way in trying to ensure quality and up-to-dateness. To be a board-certified family physician, which I am, you have to pass not only a board exam once, but you have to pass it every 6 years. And that 80% of all the questions on the exam are new knowledge in the last 6 years. And so we're the only specialty that requires that required recertification. And another specialty, once you're a board-certified surgeon, you're always a board-certified surgeon for the rest of your career, whether you crack another book or go to another meeting. Some states have got into mandating continuing education. In California, you can't keep a license to practice medicine unless you can document so many hours per year of continuing education, and that's renewed every 2 years, and that's becoming more common. But quality is an issue. I would say we're doing a better job now in medicine. We still have a long, long way to go. I say a better job because there's a lot more good education out there for the out in the trenches doctor. In the military, and you know, good enough for government work. I mean, the military tends to collect people that don't have the personality, communication skills, or otherwise wherewithal to even make it in the private sector, which isn't all that hard to do if you're a doctor. So I mean, you're gonna be. Plus, the military now has a lot of good family practice residencies. I tell people if they're gonna go find a family physician or a good general doctor, find out if the person, if they're young, at least if they're under age 45, they should have done a residency. If they haven't, they're only partially trained. Are they residency trained, board certified? If they are, you're much likely to find real quality people. But in the military, their GMOs, general medical officers, are often dropouts from a wide variety of residencies that couldn't make it, and they have a license because still in America, you can get a license after 1 year of training beyond medical school, regardless of what it is. You can go to a psychiatry residency and be thrown out in your second year and go out and get a job in some place and practice medicine because you've got that license, and the medical license is full. I mean, it's all-encompassing. It's a physician and surgeon license. So we have licensure issues. There's a big movement to stop licensure until you've truly finished training in a field of recognized specialty. That is, you won't get your license until you finish your residency. There's a strong mandate to do that. There are problems with doing that because here at our academic health center, it's very awkward if all the residents are unlicensed doctors. You got to figure out some sort of intermediate license to give them so they can function, because they really are skilled people, and if you delay licensure, the residents can't work in a community clinic and practice and do other work that they're certainly trained to do. But yeah, we really do need the profession of medicine. I don't know if it's that much worse than other professions too out there, but the profession of medicine does have important quality issues. These are being addressed more than they ever have before, but there's a long way to go.
I think we're very brief questions.
I always ask brief questions and don't make speeches. I would like to ask what you think of the role of the drug and medical supply companies and their lobbyists in determining the priorities of medical research.
They're more a part of the problem than part of the solution.
I know.
Our drug and medical supply costs are way out of line. We pay more.
Is that because of the control that they have, that they fund so much of the research?
The bottom line is capitalism. And I'm a capitalist. I mean, I'm not a socialist or communist. But the bottom line in America is basically you charge as much as the market will bear. And the profit motive, to the defense of the drug industry, it's a very risky industry. They now know that unless they can make all the money they need to make on a drug in the first year or two, they could be in trouble, because now the knowledge is such that if one new drug comes in that's better than the drug they have, their share of the market will drop overnight. And so they need to get their money. But it's way, way overpriced, and that contributes to the inflation. Plus, the drug industry has been able to maintain its profits to the extent that it's buying a lot of the good researchers. The academic purity of a lot of our universities, many doctors in medical schools have now been co-opted by the drug industry or the industry, and they get, you know, tremendous vacations, honorariums, speakerships, and they can more than double their their income as a result of endorsing certain drugs, and they claim that there's no strings attached, but of course that's a claim. There's a new drug for Parkinson's disease. It was just an example. This was a drug that was developed in Hungary, Eldepril, you're familiar with it, but developed in Hungary and sells in Hungary for about 50 cents a pill, and is now available throughout Europe at about 75 cents a pill. Well, the drug has just been approved by the FDA and is being marketed and sold in the United States for $2 a pill. You know, now, how do you defend that? The drug, you know, you're not paying R&D costs. They've already been paid. The drug's there. But it's just an example of what's happening and what our industry does.
I ask a very quick question.
Okay.
How many young people are going into family medicine? Is that being felt that it's got some, you know, feeling they, not being a specialist, they think they're in a low grade or somehow?
It's a good question. During the 1970s, there was a tremendous increase in the number of students going into family medicine. And the specialty began in 1969. Those were the first real residencies and came together recognizing it as specialty. And there was, during the 1970s, a tremendous increase such that we have about 380 programs. It's plateaued during the 1980s, hasn't increased at all, didn't decrease either. But in the last 3 years, especially, fewer and fewer medical students are wanting to go into family practice and general internal medicine and general pediatrics. They're the lowest paid specialties. They carry the less amount of prestige in the medical school. And there's the current mindset of most medical students is really to, for their, there's a lot of reasons. It's very complex, but you know, some specialties are both economically rewarding, and your hours are better, and you have the security of having fairly focused knowledge in just doing this skill or this, you know, this area, and they're exciting too. Granted, but and so we have a real imbalance of what the students want to do, and a real shortage of people going into the primary care field, such as family medicine. All of you need to help talk it up.
Well, we were told we'd get the best possible discussion of family medicine. I think we have. We have a variety of speakers who come here. We send them material. We send you material. Sometimes I think people read the material, other times maybe they don't. Dr. Scherger has read the material, I can testify, having talked earlier with him, and that's a quality that intellectual curiosity and growth that one does associate with progress, except when you pick family medicine physician of the year, I don't know where the growth can go. You're almost at the top already, but at the top or not, we hope that the University of Virginia may have ongoing and perhaps much closer contacts with Dr. Scherger in the months and years ahead. We feel proud that he's visited the Miller Center, and we look forward to association in the future.
Thank you, Kenneth, and thank you very much.
Thank you.